This is tape 3, the afternoon of January the 5th, 1961.
You're making the point, Mr. President, that if Lincoln had not been assassinated, that his undertaking of binding the wounds, etc., of the South would have been carried through because he was better skilled as a leader and politician, or what?
I think that's right. I think he was a more skillful politician than Johnson was, for the simple reason that he had to be in order to amount to anything in Illinois at that time. Illinois was a Democratic state. Stephen A. Douglas was a Democrat. And so was the great state of Pennsylvania. But Lincoln was able to get the members of the Congress to accomplish what he thought was best in carrying on the war, and I think he'd have done the same thing in carrying on the peace. He would have been able to do the same thing. He'd have had all kinds of trouble, of course. Every president does when he tries to do anything.
And just another iffy question, do you think that his position in history would have been as significant and as highlighted as it is now had he served out his second term?
I think it would have been greater for the simple reason he would have accomplished what I was saying a while ago. It took more than 40 years to accomplish. I think he would have put the thing on the road to accomplishment so that it would have not left the sores and the wounds that it did leave.
In other words, what you're saying very clearly is that it wasn't the assassination that made him great. What made him great was the action of saving the Union, and that had he not been assassinated, he could have completed that in a much faster...
That's my opinion, exactly. That's my opinion. I may be wrong as I can be, but that's my opinion. It's the greatest thing he did was to save the Union. And that's what he set out to do.
It's now in his Gettysburg Address. I would like to get your definition of that because I... first sentence has no foundation, in fact. No one has ever challenged it, but he says, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, who conceived that kind of a nation and who said so?
Thomas Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, uses almost those very same words.
That this is how we were born as a nation?
Yes. Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence was the creation of the free nation of the United States of America. When that was adopted in 1776, that set the pattern under which the Constitution was written. And it said, it used almost those exact words, all men are created equal.
But not necessarily practiced during all that time until Lincoln came along?
Well, it wasn't practiced fundamentally by a great many of the policies of the various governments, city, county, and state, and national. But Jackson made the first sincere effort to give the common people a place in the government where they belong, and he succeeded to some extent, not entirely.
May I break in here a minute? Seized in liberty, saved in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition. Now you may be proposition. Now you may be dedicated to a proposition, which does not necessarily mean that you've carried it out. I don't know what your question is.
It's a wonderful statement.
That.
Well, I mean, we happen to come here looking for opportunities and other things. I just want to get back to the origin as to whether or not we were conceived in liberty.
If you remember. I know in my childhood, it was customary, at every 4th of July celebration to read the Declaration of Independence, written by Thomas Jefferson, and that's where that came from. He undoubtedly read it himself at some 4th of July celebration and was acquainted with it completely.
Well, at what point have we been brought forth? But certainly not in the pre-revolutionary period.
May I suggest while the president answers, Dave, that's rhetorical, Dave.
Yes,
that
I know.
That doesn't necessarily...
Well, I think we've been growing to it all the time. Never a year goes by that there's not some improvement.
In the approach to the
situation of the people who are not, well, what you may say, the people who haven't any pull. Franklin Roosevelt did one of the greatest jobs to be done in that line, and so did Woodrow Wilson. They both... Those two late presidents were working on that very proposition, and it's a continuing proposition. It'll have to be worked on all the time. Because when wealth gets control, a tendency to pound the people under them into the ground, and somebody's got to wake them up. And eventually, they are waking up, as you find in all through the history of the country. Some president has come along and made an effort to implement that very statement that's made in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and is made by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence.
Because this has been many languages and has been some of the source material that agitated other people to revolution, people in one of
the American Revolution. The American Revolution is a strong I still contend that's where it started, in the American Revolution.
Well, then Lincoln, in a sense, has revitalized the revolution and given it new life.
Every peasant has to do it to some extent. You take the great message of the paper, Roosevelt's opening message when he was inaugurated in 1933 on March 4th. The last president to be inaugurated on the 4th of March, used exactly the same approach. He said the only thing we had to fear is fear itself. Let's go to work now, put things in the ground, that's his message on it, hit everybody where they live, and they went to work.
Are you suggesting, Mr. President, that freedom and the Republican form of government goes on because it's necessary to revitalize it from time to time?
And any question about that? It's an intangible situation, and it has to be brought to life every time it looks as if it's going out the window. And if it isn't, well, then it does go out the window, and then we have a dictatorship.
That is why you're always warning against taking anything for granted. Always keep working at the...
That's true. I must keep working at it. It's absolutely essential. After which this government was founded, as Lincoln was trying to revitalize it after the war between the states.
Now, in his very next sentence, he says, "We're now in this war to prove whether we can any nation so conceived can endure."
That's right.
You made a point a bit ago that there are only two successful revolutions that took place that endured. Ours was one, and
yes,
the Russian is the other.
Totalitarian is the other.
Will you evaluate him at this point in terms of the, not only the renewal, but the fact that had we not won the war, had we not succeeded, that would have been the end of the Republic? That would have been the end.
I think it would have been three or four republics if that separation had succeeded. I always contended that the northeast section of the country would have been the United States under the Constitution. The Confederate Constitution would have operated in the 11 southern states, and I'm just as sure as I can be that the French would have been successful in setting up their empire in Mexico if the Republic had not survived the war between the states. And the southwestern part of the country would have then been taken over, Russia might have kept its northwest section of the country and established a Russian approach on this continent, which would have been a terrible thing.
Now, but in any case, we would not be the power we are today.
No, we became a great power as a result of the success in maintaining the Union as the United States of America.
Well, then, in terms of the presidency, Washington and Lincoln are the only two that have really made sure of the survival and the development.
Washington set up the government and Lincoln made it work.
Well, Mr. President, therefore, union is one of the basic things of American freedom. Because when you suggest that there might have been five republics or five separate
different
nations,
sets of governments on.
That would make for strife and conflict as a group of nations always lead to.
As it goes on right now in Central America all the time. You've got five or six little republics down there that are always at each other's throats.
In other words, you see in union, and you see in union something more than form. You see that almost as the vital basis of freedom.
That's right. The Republic of Mexico is another example of what union does. They've got a strong government in Mexico that covers every state in that United States of Mexico, they call it. And that's about the only way you can make this thing work. Brazil's in the same fix. Brazil has a strong central government, not too strong, but a strong central government made up of a number of states. And I think ours is the first example of complete success.
Well, these two governments, good as they are, they're not to be compared with the greatness and development and the flourishing kind of society that has developed within the United States.
No, it's in the class by itself. And I hope it'll stay that way.
Well, now, then you...
Excuse me, Mayor, I think the President was suggesting that union is necessary to bring about any successful form of government rather than division.
That's right.
Well, that only in the sense of survival, but there's another dimension, the dimension of greatness, the enormity of the development followed this thing.
Well, one of the reasons for the tremendous development of this nation of ours was its almost inexhaustible resources. Its resources from your cultural standpoint, from the mineral standpoint, and from nearly every other standpoint that you want to bring up. And it was also a mixture of the best of the European nations, which we call the melting pot. And we got the best out of every nation in Europe. And we're not an inbred, at least not yet, an inbred bunch of people. And that makes for the best in everything. The reason the Japanese emperors have continued for 2,500 years is because they are not inbred and intermarried with what they call in Europe royalty. The reason for the downfall of the Ptolemies in Egypt was because of the fact that they were completely inbred before they got through. Some very brilliant men in that line of kings, the Ptolemy kings, but finally ran out.
Well, but again, we have had...
Go ahead.
What is that? Are we on again?
It's
well, the position of Lincoln, and in terms of our evolution as a people, is extraordinary in many ways. And could you, over and above his capacity as a great leader, what were the essential contributions?
Well, the greatest and most essential contribution that he made was the saving of the Union and preventing it from being split up into four or five nations. I think that's the most important thing that he did. And then he set an example that a man who has the ability can be president of the United States no matter what his background is.
Well, now, his administration was not noted for its probity, his administration, too.
And more the administration after him, too. Well, that's always the case. You have to keep, and that's the reason a reorganization of the government is a continuing thing. Because as the country grows and the government becomes bigger, for men to go wrong in places of responsibility, and it's too bad they're that way, but every executive, whether he's a mayor of a city or of the United States, must be constantly at work. Efficiency of the government, an option in it. That's his duty. That's part of his job.
Now, well, freeing the slave in a legal sense, not in a practical sense, was the great monumental achievement of the Lincoln administration.
Yes, because that did away with the labor situation in the South on which they absolutely depended, and that was a blow. Because the economy had to be carried on. And the Southerners had one crop economy which could not be carried on when their labor was put out of business.
This is the end of tape 3, January 5th, 1961, the afternoon. This is tape 4, the afternoon of January 5, 1961. President, you're talking. We're talking about slavery as
this great result of all this bloodshed did make an important contribution to the world as well as our own.
Yes, that's true. The British had freed their slaves along in the 40s, I think, and a great many of the other countries had done the same thing. They've done it in all the countries except the Muslim countries. They still have slavery in Morocco and in Arabia. And in one or two other of those Muslim countries, but The freedom of the slaves in this country was one of the great assets of that war because it created an integrated economy all over the country, and the industrial revival of the South that's been taking place in the last 15 to 20 years is one of the best things that ever happened to that part of the country.
Well, actually, the slave habit grew with us. It was not part of our origin or development.
It grew with us for the simple reason that it was national in scope when it first started, because they didn't have the necessary labor force to carry on the business that was necessary to be carried on at that time. Massachusetts and Connecticut and New York and New Jersey, all of them had slaves to begin with. But they finally went into an industrial program and sold the slaves south, and then my mother used to say came down and stole them back.
Well, in other words, it was not only a great human deed to free the slaves, but it really brought people back to the senses of what the real sound economic basis of labor and the industry should be.
That's
free
true.
Labor.
That's absolutely true. The reason the Roman Republic in the beginning was a great republic is because everybody worked. Everybody had something to do, and everybody had a part in carrying on the business of the republic, both by sea and by land.
Well, there were some moves on the hill in an effort to indemnify the southern landowners by issuing bonds and compensating them some way, somehow, for the release of the slaves.
I don't know. There was a lot of talk about it, but no real effort was ever made to do it, and I don't think it could have been done because it would have been involved at that time a tremendous amount of money at a proper place to have stopped it was in 1809, at the time it was decided when the Constitution was written, they would begin to eliminate it at that time, but it wasn't carried through.
And of course, the people of the South had always taken the position that they were taking care of their Negro slaves in a very humane way, but that the Northern industrialists were really enslaving their people and exploiting them.
Well, they did do just that very thing until the labor unions came forth and then remedied the situation. Before the labor unions became powerful enough to look after the welfare of their members, it was virtually slavery to work in any of these factories. That's the way old Andrew Carnegie got rich, was by pounding down the people who made steel for him. And then, of course, when he died so rich, I think his conscience hurt him in the manner in which he handled these things, and he left a lot of it for libraries. And it was a good thing.
Well, he had terrible strikes and a lot of bloodshed on his place,
right,
too. So
same
there were little civil wars up there, too.
Pullman strike, when they Pullman called out the soldiers to stop the Pullman strike in Cleveland's second administration.
Well, now, how did the emancipation of the slave in the South work to project us to the rest of the world? What was our position then after this happened?
Well, I think we got a much better reputation abroad after the labor was entirely free in this country than we had before. We're bound to have had. But we had a terrible time in between. We were talking about Andrew Carnegie and his steelworks. The same thing happened in the Tennessee Coal and Iron and the Colorado Fuel and Iron outfit. They had a regular war in Colorado, and that Colorado Fuel and Iron people, a situation where there were a tremendous number of laboring men killed. The same thing happened in the Tennessee Coal and Iron. But that seems now a thing of the past, and we hope it'll never happen again in this country.
Those are much later, though. Those are after the
those are along in the 90s.
Now, Mr. President, did we then achieve a different status with respect to our relations with the rest of the world after this happened?
I don't think we achieved any outstanding world status until after the First World War. When the League of Nations was attached to the treaty which Woodrow Wilson negotiated, that's our first stand as a world power. And we've been getting stronger ever since. And of course, the thing happened that Wilson and all the rest of us thought would happen when the Second World War came along as a result of our not being a part of the League of Nations. And we've tried now to organize a United Nations organization on the same basis as the League was organized, to try and keep peace in the world. And the only thing that stands in the way of peace now is the totalitarian states of Russia and China. You believe in tyranny and government from the top without any representation of the common people in it.
In other words, up to the First World War, and our taking a position in that, the struggle and the life which went on this continent here, rather in the United States, was really a struggle to maintain and develop the liberties we had.
And was developed and caused the growth and the settlement of all that unsettled part of the country, which was west of the Appalachian Mountains. That was a continuing proposition. It became industrial centers in the Ohio and the Mississippi valleys, and the farmlands in the west were developed to the point where we could feed the world twice over even now. We have surplus food stuff, which no other country in the history of the world ever had until this time. And at that time you're talking about, between the Civil War and the present time, Britain and France and Germany were the great powers of that period. And that created the balance of power with Russia in the background, always tied up with France and Britain, Germany, Austria, and Italy on the other side of the fence. And that's what was called a balance of power at that time. Well, of course, that was destroyed. And the United Nations was set up in a hope that there would be a balance of power through the United Nations. It hasn't happened yet, but I think it will eventually happen. And I've said time and again, it took us 80 years to implement our own constitution. You can't expect it. Yeah, cause a world constitution to work in less time than that anyway.
After all, then, the important point to keep in mind, as you see it, is that up to the time of Woodrow Wilson, or rather with the advent of Woodrow Wilson, a new era, a new period, a new change came to this nation.
That's true.
So far as the world was concerned.
That's true, except that it was sabotaged in the 20s and had to be started over after the Second World War.
Well, Lincoln didn't implement the Constitution literally. He was changing it, wasn't he?
He kept it working all the time after he had won the war. Of course, he had to stretch it to it, just as Jefferson did when he bought Louisiana.
No, but the Emancipation Proclamation was a in a sense, a rewrite of the Constitution.
It was a sense of the confiscation of private property. That's what it amounted to.
Would you explain that?
It was cured by the amendments to the Constitution which were passed at that time. 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, or three of them. And those amendments had to be approved when the old states of the Confederacy were allowed to come back into the Union. They had to endorse the Constitution of the United States, and every new state has to do that.
Well, Texas and South Carolina held out, I guess, the only two?
No, I don't think so. I think
Texas
they both
held out.
They
Texas wouldn't sign.
They may have been a long time coming in, but they had to, and they couldn't be represented in the Congress.
Now, this is the very critical point at which we were beginning to, as you say, evolve into a fully representative constitution.
That's right.
And now, what moral impact did this civil war have on the rest of the world?
I don't know. I don't know whether it had any serious effect or not. I think the greatest effect that it's had on the rest of the world was Woodrow Wilson's 14 points and the final adoption of the United Nations Charter. I think that had more effect from our viewpoint on the rest of the world than any other one thing we did. I don't think the Civil War had much of an impact on the rest of the world.
Well, may I ask you, didn't it have this effect that the powers of Europe realized that they could not dismember that great core of people living in this area, the United States, and therefore didn't lead to any adventures.
I don't think they found out about it until Grover Cleveland put England in its place when they were trying to take a piece of Venezuela. That's where they began to realize that the voice of the United States had to be heard before anything happened in the Western Hemisphere. Now, after Woodrow Wilson's time, the voice of the United States is heard around the world. And if you study the history of the thing, you'll find that the capital for the development of a great part of this country was furnished by Britain, Holland, and France. And then when the terrible First World War came along, all those assets of those countries were cased in this country to carry on the war and expended here, which caused a great expansion in our industrial plant. It made us the greatest industrial country in the world at that time.
Although there was this important Monroe Declaration that we had, what you're saying is that actually Grover Cleveland was the first president to make anybody stop in this
hemisphere. That's right. He's the one that made it work. And the only reason the Monroe Doctrine could stand up was because Britain controlled the seas. And our ally on the subject.
And Britain was willing to back the Monroe Doctrine for its own purpose.
They're the first ones who tried to break it.
Britain helped us keep others out, then we had to keep Britain out.
That's right. That's the way it
Cleveland was the first to do that.
He did that in his Venezuelan ultimatum to Great Britain.
Now, to get back to Lincoln for another second, his assassination, his death, was mourned by the entire civilized world.
That's true. That's true. I think that was true of McKinley, too.
Was he equally mourned around the world?
Yes, all around the world he was mourned. I was in Texas when it happened. I'll never forget.
Tell us about it.
Well, I was down visiting my uncle, my father's older brother. And he had two boys just the age of my brother and myself, and half a dozen girls and some stepchildren. And Ralph Truman and I were down there on a visit. And I was in Dallas at the time in September 1901. I'll never forget it. The word came that the president had been assassinated by a crank in Buffalo, New York. And of course, that stopped all the wheels from going. And the whole world mourned the loss of the head of the United States government, as they did when Roosevelt died, if you remember. That was an international affair, just to say, oh yes, any other one thing.
Why would they mourn McKinley, and why in Texas would this be such a shocking thing, since?
Well, they were just sorry to see the head of the state assassinated. And nobody wants to have a man assassinated, particularly when he's in a place of responsibility such as President of the United States or Governor of a state.
Would you suggest then, Mr. President, in answer to Dave's question, that by the time of McKinley, the prestige of the United States was growing all the time in the world.
It began to grow and expand. That's true. That's true, but then assassination of any public official is a terrible thing. You remember when the governor of Kentucky was assassinated, the whole country went into mourning as a result of it. Global motion.
And now, again, Lincoln has monuments erected to him in many parts of the world,
That's true.
No other president, with the possible exemption now of FDR, maybe.
Wilson and FDR in the same class. They have in London and Paris and in Rome, there's a monument to Wilson. And there's monuments now being put up for Roosevelt everywhere. There's one in London. I was there just a short time after it was unveiled. And there's a street in Nice named the Woodrow Wilson Boulevard. And there's a monument to Roosevelt and Wilson both in Paris. Do you know where to find them?
Now, we're not erecting any monuments here to any kings or any potentates in this country, and yet they've been doing it to our president.
Well, we have a great many monuments all around over the country to various people. They deserve them, I think.
Sorry, Mr. President, this is on a tape for the afternoon, January 5th.
I think we better knock off now.